Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
Now it's time for our Friday gathering, and this week we're joined by Fianna Fáil TD for Galway East and Minister of State at the Department of Children, Equality, Disability, Integration and Youth, Anne Rabbitt, Independent TD for Wexford, Verona Murphy, Deputy Political Editor, Political Editor of the Sunday Times, Hugh O'Connell. Caught myself there.
Thanks,
apologies, Hugh.
That's okay.
We're going to be talking about the US election in a moment, so I can't really we can't really give off too much about Joe Biden's momentary lapses if I'm making them like that myself. And media consultant and founder of Effective Age Ukraine, Tom McEnany. Thanks very much all for joining us. Now, it's been a weekend dominated by political debates, from the final leaders' debate in the UK between Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer, but last night's showdown between Trump and Biden. I didn't have the pleasure or task of sitting up at 2 a.m. last night, Hugh, to watch the whole thing. But the clips this morning, if they're representative of the overall debate, whether they are or not, it wasn't a good look for the Democrat Party.
No, I mean, look, I haven't watched the full debate myself, but like most people, I've seen some of the clips this morning. And I guess, you know, television debates are, if they are memorable, they are memorable for moments. And it appears there were a number of moments last night where Joe Biden's fragilities were badly exposed, and he lost his train of thought, and he didn't answer questions in a very coherent manner. And that has exposed, I think, the concerns that Democrats have had about Joe Biden for some time now, that he does not have the capacity to do a second term as US president. And I think we saw in some of the briefing that took place after the debate that there's a very real concern now that debate is a game changer in this election, that it potentially sinks his chances of re-election. And there seems to be a conversation beginning about, is there any way in which we could get this guy to stand down and replace him with another candidate in advance of the Democratic convention later this summer, and basically go to the country with a different candidate. That seems to me, to my mind, at this point in time, to be a remote prospect. But certainly, I think there'll be the sorts of conversations being had this morning or later within Democratic circles in the US. There'll be more open conversations than they were up to this point. I mean, there's been concerns from several years that Biden wasn't capable of doing a second term, and I think those concerns will be to the fore now after last night's performance. Where, I mean, you know, the crazy thing about it almost is that, you know, we don't really know what Donald Trump said, because all we're seeing in the clips is Joe Biden, you know, incapable of answering questions in a coherent manner.
Anne Rabbitt, on a human level, you know, the lights are on, you're in a 2-hour studio debate, you've had several advisors shouting lines in your ear. It could happen to the best of us, but, you know, when you're over 80 years of age, maybe there's a greater likelihood of it happening, and the appearance of it is not good for the Democrats.
And I suppose I can imagine it being in anybody's position, like what you're after saying. The lights are on, you have been scripted, you have been learning your lines, and then you forget a line. And then you try to remember your lines and you put in different words, and it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And to be honest with you, what's been pulled is the 40 seconds, 45 seconds of a possibly a 90-minute debate, and which condenses it all in. And it's a politician's worst nightmare, to be honest with you. But if you're 81 years of age and you're looking for re-election, what I didn't realise is there's only 3 years of an age gap between himself and Donald Trump. And even though there's only 3 years of an age gap, there certainly was... Donald Trump appeared to be far more coherent, far more energetic, far more fluid with his own lines, and was totally unscripted, to be honest with you.
So which Verona Murphy is an easier task, if you're being briefed by several advisors to hit all the policy points and stick to the facts. If you're unshackled from the facts and the statistics and the briefing documents, and you're effectively just riffing, it's an easier task.
Well, look, as an independent, I'm like that all the time. But no, I look, it's not funny. It is on a human level. It's actually quite sad to watch. And I've been seeing clips and people have been showing me clips of him in recent times whereby he seems to go off. Kamala Harris seems to bring him back by the elbow, different people. But I think the reality is, look, 81 years of age is a significant age to have all your faculties, to be doing the job of American president. I find it extraordinary. And the most comment people make to me is that it's amazing that with the population of America, these are the two offerings as candidates for the nominations of president. So I think, look, at like you, I think, is there any way that he may or may not step aside? Do they have a replacement that would be able for Donald Trump? You know, I just think it's quite pitiful, to be honest, that he has served his time. He's still there, but I think to go out with dignity would be far better than a continuation of what we're seeing at the moment on a human level.
All right. As against that, Tom McEnany, whether you agree with people's politics or not, there are more, I suppose, dynamic people at that age. I mean, the late Garrett Fitzgerald was pretty dynamic until close to his end. Bernie Sanders in the US is, you know, of a similar age to both candidates there. He's pretty lively. It doesn't seem to be just down to age.
I don't think it was his age. I think it was his performance. I think on a better day, he might have done reasonably well. Like most people, I was judging it based on the clips. And I suppose, like in most people, I was cringing listening to Joe Biden talk about 1,000 trillionaires in America and then continue on to make a whole series of mistakes. He had one job, and that was to deliver a script and do so in a way that didn't make him look febrile, and he failed in that job. And over the next, if he remains as the candidate, that's as Hugh says, that's a question that I think Democrats will be asking themselves for the next couple of weeks at least. But if he remains as the candidate for the next 4 months, he has to constantly now prove himself. He has to constantly now work against this presumption that he's just not up for the job.
Right, well, maybe that's, you know, Hugh O'Connell, no bad thing that, you know, having thought that he was going to win it on the competency level, he now has to up it on the performance level.
Yeah, totally. But I mean, most of the polls would indicate that he was on course to lose this election anyway. And the Biden campaign sought this debate very early. I think it's the earliest there's ever been a presidential debate. For the purposes of kind of blowing Trump out of the water.
The ground rules should have suited him.
No audience, mics being cut off when candidates weren't speaking. He, by all accounts, spent the last week in advance of this debate, cooped up in Camp David with his team, preparing. He knew the questions, he knew the ground rules, he knew how it was going to play out, but yet he wasn't able to do it. So now that, you know, I mean, he will have and is expected to have several set piece events between now and November, not least accepting the Democratic nomination at the convention later in the summer. There is another debate scheduled, for example, I think in September, possibly a bit later. But there are all these moments that he has to build up to. And yes, he has to now prove himself. Because I think most indications and even the markets shifting and all of the kind of predictions now are that, right. Projections are that Donald Trump's going to win this election in November, if it carries on. So there needs to be, last night was a game changer, I think. And so there needs to be another game changer in order to swing momentum back to.
I am going to move on now, but no pressure on that one, Joe, because I'm going to move on to the EU Migration Pact, which was voted through in the Dáil during the week. Tom, you're working directly with Ukrainian migrants. The EU Asylum and Migration Pact, of course, it doesn't apply to beneficiaries of temporary protection. But whatever about the theory of the EU Migration and Asylum Pact, how do you think it's going to go in practice?
Well, I'm supportive of the EU Migration Pact in general, in theory. I think it's a good idea to have a general pact across all EU countries. I think it's a good idea to throw resources at improving processing times. I'm very, very concerned that in practice, in Ireland at least, it's going to be a disaster. What we're finding, it's all about how it's been implemented. It's all about whether we inject compassion, which is a word that Simon Harris used to talk about.
Yeah, what area in particular do you see most cause for danger?
We find what we're seeing at at the moment is the government has closed over 125 different centres for Ukrainians and has moved, forcibly removed, over 5,000 Ukrainian, almost all women and children, over the last number of months in what amounts to a national campaign of disintegration. And it's done this saying to kids, listen, say goodbye to your friends and your schoolmates and you're going to be going somewhere else, turning around to mothers, many of whom have jobs, and saying, say goodbye to your work and we're going to move you into another centre somewhere where you don't know, where you'll be unemployed and you'll be forced to look after your family on the new rate of 39 euros per week. And that's happening at the same time when, for the first time over the next couple of weeks, newly arrived Ukrainian refugees, again, almost all women and children, who've been coming since March and have been told that you only get government accommodation for 90 days, despite the fact that the government is swimming in so much excess accommodation for Ukrainians that it's closed down over 125 centres and is continuing to close centres almost every day. It's saying to those, you're out on the street. And I can tell you that almost every other organisation that I work with is at the moment holding its breath, just waiting for a Ukrainian family to be forced out on the street. Not only out on the street, but without access to state homeless services.
OK, serious concerns been raised there by Tom McEnany and Rabbit. We saw most recently in Loophead, in County Clare, the local residents out protesting in solidarity with the Ukrainian residents there to be moved on and disrupted in the way that Tom McEnany is talking about. So is that a portent of what's going to happen at the implementation of the Asylum and Migration Pact?
No, I think, to be quite honest with you, I think they're two, they're similar conversations. What was the Migration Pact the other night was actually about actually putting shape, having solidarity across Europe, sharing databases and ensuring that where people had entered point of entries, that if they had decided to flee that particular country or leave that country and come to Ireland, we had a way of picking up the mechanism to see where they had first entered.
But it also contains...
Going back to Tom's piece.
Yeah, sure. It also contains... prescriptions on the basic decent standard of accommodation, how people in those centres should be treated when they are being put up there. So there's a human rights component to it. But what Tom McEnany is referring to there, how capable of the government is the government of implementing those aspects of it?
So I think it's important to say, first and foremost, we as a government and we as a state are compassionate and understanding. And I don't take your point well, Tom, to say that we're...
that to the 5,000 Ukrainians be moved...
Sorry, I didn't interrupt you now, Tom. So I think it's important just to let me speak. To be quite honest with you, I totally take on board, Tom, what you're saying in relation to the women and children, where the children have made friends, where they have been totally integrated, the fact that they have to move on. But we're not... I don't understand the context. Was it a hotel? What was the level of accommodation? Was there a need for that accommodation to be returned? Did not meet the fire regs that the local authorities have to present to the department for that tender to be expanded. So there's varying factors as to why people have to move from one accommodation to another. And I suppose really we need to pair back to where this really started. It was always about providing safety and shelter.
And just to be clear, we're not raising any concern about the particular fire regulations
in any accommodation that was in the papers. But what I'm trying to say, there is a gamut of reasons as to why government or why the Minister for Integration finds himself in a situation where actually there's notice to quit are served in certain centres.
I'll come back to you, Tom McEnany, but I do want to go to Verona Murphy. You voted against the EU Asylum and Migration Pact. So what's your solution in terms of greater European cooperation where there is cross-border movement of people?
Well, for a start, we absolutely need migration. I think that's the caveat everybody needs to understand. We're an economy with full employment and we need migration. Ireland is not full. The reality is we need controlled migration. We are doing a disservice to all and sundry that this situation has got completely out of hand. You can see now from what Tom is saying, integration isn't planned. There is actually no integration plan. And without integration, migration is actually pointless. We see it in South County Wexford. We have people out on the furthest point of the Hook Peninsula in a holiday village, which... it serves no purpose for integration. The children go to school and that's it.
And how will voting against the EU Asylum and Migration Pact alleviate that?
Because obviously, as you said, Colm, at the outset, it doesn't pertain to temporary protections regards that. However, if we don't control the numbers, we are looking at detention centres to facilitate upwards of, according to Roger O'Gorman's figures, upwards of 30,000 people per annum. We are processing about six people a day. Six people a day. We need to do about 600 a week. But the reality is...
But there's an implementation plan due in November. There's supposed to be a draft implementation plan due in November. The implementation plan is supposed to be drawn up...
And you believe we'll go from 600 in that length of time? Because that's what needs to happen according to the pact and according to the delivery from the Minister for Justice.
My point is it's not due in until 2026. And I think the Department of Justice accepts that they'll need about four times even the lawyers that they have at the moment by that time. You don't have faith that will be in place,
do you? No, I don't have
faith
in the delivery at all, and I think we need to decide for ourselves as a country on the periphery of the EU how we are going to deal with this.
And how would you do it for all?
There's many ways to do it, and controlled migration, and we do that through the visa and employment permit system, and actually that's a system that's broken also, because
that system
has slowed to the extent. The asylum is it comes where we are not advocating. We have self-deportation. We are allowing that to continue. We're talking about, look, if you want me to say the minister came out with the fine for the airlines as if it was a solution, increasing the fine to 5,000, all it does is prolong it.
Right.
It means that the asylum seeker, really important column, the asylum seeker is arrested, he's incarcerated, and when his incarceration time ends, he then or she then seeks asylum.
But the Asylum and Immigration Pact, if you arrive without the documents, without the correct documents or falsified documents, or if you come from a country of under 20% success rate in asylum applications, or if there's a security flag has been raised about you on Eurodac, you go into an accelerated 3-month process at the end of which...
Which I have several represented to me from the IPAS Centre in Rosslare who are there now for over 18 months, haven't been assessed in the 3 months, but they can't work. They want to work because they've appealed the 3-month ruling. They haven't been deported, they haven't been served deportation orders, so it's not working.
Okay, but the Asylum and Migration Pact, it has to be said, is not in place yet. Hugh O'Connell, it's okay to pass it, but in terms of resourcing it and implementing it, it's a different kettle of fish.
But that's the challenge now, I guess. And I guess signing up to the pact is Ireland's way and the government's way of saying that this is part of how we're going to control migration, as you say, Verona. And I think the biggest concern that voters have had over immigration in the last while is this sense that the government wasn't on top of the situation. It was allowing things like the tented city outside the IP centre, the IPAS centre in Dublin, the situation along Grand Canal, which is still not ideal. It's fenced off beyond recognition now at this stage. But this sense of the government not being in control, and I think signing up to the Migration Pact is part of that in terms of bringing a semblance of control to this situation. But there will be all sorts of unintended consequences that will flow from that, not least these kind of these accommodation centres near ports and airports, which the government are saying are not going to be detention centres, but which I think a lot of people might look at from the perspective of a human rights perspective, that maybe they are tantamount to detention centres.
And whatever they are, Andra, but they have to be built first. I mean, we have no clarity as to when these six centres will be built. We don't know if the planning permission is in from the yet, whether all the sites have been identified. The communication around this, would you accept, has been less than clear?
I would accept that it isn't clear, Colm. Absolutely, I would. But at the same time, we do need those five or six centres, for the simple reason being, in order to ensure that the processing is adhered to and in a timely fashion, Verona. Absolutely, I take on board your point that it has to be in a timely fashion, that people have the right and the dignity to actually pass through into work or actually that they're given the right to leave. And I think listening to Minister McEntee, the last thing people want on their passports is deportation, because it actually restricts their movement.
All right, so Tom McEnany, you wanted to respond to something there.
Two things, if I may. First of all, whether we're dealing with Ukrainians or refugees from every other country, best practice internationally is a focus on integration. And the government's current campaign of forced disintegration for Ukrainian refugees just shouts loudly that the government doesn't consider integration to be important, number one. And number two, with the greatest of respect to Anne Rabbit, suggesting that these centres are being closed because of issues such as fire regulations is a best disingenuous when her own department, in a briefing note to politicians during the week, said that they were being closed in order to save money. Although starting off with those where compliance had been an issue, but continuing on, it said very, very clearly, and this is from her own department, in a briefing note to politicians, that they were being closed to save money.
All right. Sorry, Colm, can I just come in here first and foremost? I think you have been really disingenuous when you say we don't do integration. We have integration funds to support community groups. And I come from East Galway, where I have seen how community groups have worked really, really well in Loughrea and in Esker and in Athenry and in various places, Kiltormer, where integration, where people put their hand up and came forward and ensured that the children were accommodated and supported in school and in various activities, the same way with the mothers and the partners that were there.
That's community action too.
No, but it is being supported. So that's where the integration fund column.
Is it part of an overarching plan to help integration with people, or is it where people happen to find themselves in community? The local GAA club has an outreach, or there's a tea morning organised for people, and it's ad hoc?
No, it's not ad hoc, because it is actually supported through the SICAP programme, through the rural development programmes. It's supported through many of the family resource centres and supported through the local authorities.
Well, there's no family resource centre in Hooghead, I can tell you that.
Well, you have a local authority.
It's very worrying. Listening to you, Anne, it's really worrying as to what you've heard for the last 2 years, because I can tell you the integration isn't there, and the community fund, as Colm points out, doesn't provide a transport infrastructure. It doesn't provide the doctors.
Well, I didn't point that out. My point is
that that's not the kind of funding that we're seeing. We're seeing ad hoc 500 euros and 1,000 euros here and there. We need proper integration where people are going to not just go to school, their children go to school, they need to integrate as families into the community,
just
get jobs. And
just briefly, it's been framed as, you know, something that, you know, needs to be controlled, and you know, every country will have its limits. But the EU is doing its damnedest. It's paying 3 billion to Turkey. It's going into Africa and asking countries that had freedom of movement before to seal borders. It's providing, you know, border guards with funding, with dodgy human rights records, with fundings to harden up those borders. There's people still coming across the Mediterranean, and issues of climate change and conflict and all of those things are not going to change. Is it time to manage people's expectations on the degree to which this can be controlled, Hugh O'Connell?
Well, yeah, I think this is an issue now that we're going to live with, where we're going to have 30,000 plus maybe people coming into the country every year, because that's the global trends, you know, as you said, famine, climate change, conflict, it's driving these migration trends. That's the broader issue. That's the root cause. And so tackling that is a much bigger problem. It's not easily solved, but it involves closer cooperation. It doesn't involve kind of erecting a fence and closing your borders or...
It involves building houses.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. Like, but geez, that's okay. That was a problem before all of this, anyway,
Verona.
But
it's a huge part on the basis, Hugh, that if you have a 30,000 influx of migrant population and we're only building 30,000 houses a year when we need 60 already.
We need to be having a conversation about this, where we accept that is the norm now, whereas it wasn't 2 years ago.
Okay.
We're in a crisis point now, but this will be the norm for years to come.
I just on the housing issue, because I do want to get to this, but before we wrap up today, is the issue of housing. This affordable, or what is deemed affordable in a house purchase scheme in Coolock, was a three-bed semi-detached house priced at 475,000, and the scheme would support buyers on an income of 106,000 euro per annum. Hugh O'Connell, just give us the background to this.
Yeah, this is Oscar Traynor Road, and what the opposition have been saying this week is that they warned when the state basically gave this site away for development, the developer's name escapes me, but that this is what would happen. That these houses would not be affordable, or most of these houses would not be affordable. And so they're looking at, they're pointing to this situation now where it's 475,000 euro. You need a combined income of 106,000 euro to get one of these three-bed houses, for example. I think that Pascal Donoghue was out this morning pointing out that that's not necessarily the norm, that this is just one example plucked from this scheme. But I think it is indicative of the issue of affordability, and the issue of affordability is linked to supply, and there's simply not enough supply being built. I think it's interesting that the opposition have alighted on this issue. They're calling for a reconsideration of the scheme. I don't necessarily know how that would work. These houses will be sold ultimately. People will will be in these houses, because there are plenty of people with those incomes that can afford to buy these houses. But obviously it doesn't do anything right. for the people who are on an income of 60, 70,000 euro who are in desperate need of housing and have no prospect of getting on the housing ladder.
Okay, it should be said that the market price is calculated for these kinds of houses. That was calculated about 500,000 euro for a three-bed semi-D. And then affordable was defined as 85% of the market price. But when you have a market that is heated to the point it's at now, Anne Rabbitt, and you have constrained supply, albeit growing, and the price of credit dropping, take all of that into consideration. And then the fact that the developer was building on public land, so there wasn't a land cost to this, does it augur well for, you know, where the affordable housing scheme is going from here?
I suppose, Colm, it's important just to back it up a little bit here that and put it into context. We're looking at one element of the scheme. We're not looking at the scheme in its entirety. So there is availability of affordable houses there from 265,000 up to and including 475. It is not, the entire scheme is not at that price by any manner means.
The ones that are around the 200,000 price point, what size are they?
They're one bed.
Okay.
But I just think it's important to just to say that. And the average, mean average of new A-rated houses in Dublin at the moment for three beds is 535,000. And the surveyors say, the surveyors institute says that the average build is 461,000. So it's important to just put in that context. Plus there's 1,850 other houses on the affordable scheme being built across 16 other local authorities right across the country as we speak. And at the same time, it is bringing more supply on demand.
So okay, but even when you cite the 200,000 euro example, you're still looking at a single person on around 50,000 euro or a couple on 50,000 each for this to be affordable.
Yes, that is the fact. And like sometimes, like it's not perfect. I'm not saying, Colin, by any manner or means that this is perfect. But at the same time, we are going in the right direction to try and start building affordable houses that
I
people
think
can
the
afford.
Point that's okay, being missed is that on 106,000, it's not affordable to them, even if it's a combined income. It's 475,000 is the cost. And we still need some form of government support in order to get them over the line for a mortgage. It's four times their earnings. The other side of that is, if we're supporting them at the build, after the build stage in mortgage applications, the cost of the site has to be taken into account here. And I think what this whole story depicts is that we can actually, the developers can supply land and build houses cheaper than the government are able to give away the land and have them built for them. And I think that's primarily...
Can you say that definitively, even in Dublin?
Well, definitively in Dublin. Sure, this is a point, case in point. 475,000, add the side cost, which is an
average... Well, the market value is calculated at 500,000 euro and then this is discounted on that.
So you think the side value is 20?
No, I'm saying that the market value is calculated at 500,000 euro and 475 is a discount on that. So I'm just wondering...
So what do you think the site value is, Colm? It's about 100,000. If it's 20% of the value, which it generally is, it's calculated between 20 and 30%. I'm using the lower average of 20%. We are going to subsidise every three-bed semi, it would appear, by 120,000 euros.
All right, Tom McEnany.
Taxpayers' money.
A large part of the problem is the naming of this. I think most people, or a lot of people certainly, would call... Would deem it offensive to call a 475,000 euro house affordable, particularly anybody on an average wage. I did a search on DAF this morning, in fairness to the government. I did a search on DAF this morning and I found that these houses on Oscar Traynor Woods, the Masonettes, the ones at the bottom end, are actually the cheapest available in Dublin right now. So they're cheaper than other ones that are available. They're certainly not affordable. The question is, and I know it's only one part of it, but is the government, and I accept that the government has been throwing a lot of things at the housing problem, but is the state in the business of subsidising 500,000 euro houses for people on incomes over 100,000 a year? And I would say no, and it's certainly something that should be reviewed.
All right.
And instead the government should be focusing on why local authorities across the country are not better at building social housing.
Okay, and we have to give you the last word on that today, because that is our last.